From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Some of Hollywood's greatest films were born right here in Georgia. And today we'll talk with the filmmakers behind two of those classics, Fried Green Tomatoes and My Cousin Vinny, two very different films. Before we do that, we hope you will take a moment to support this show. We're in the middle of our spring fund drive. You can go to gpb.org and click donate. It only takes about 90 seconds, or call 800-222-4788. That's quick, also. Last year, the Atlanta Film Festival paid tribute to the movie Fried Green Tomatoes. It was first released in 1991. The film stars Kathy Bates, Jessica Tandy, Mary Louise Parker, and Mary Stuart Masterson. And it's set in rural Alabama, but it was filmed in Juliet, Georgia, just north of Macon. I started the conversation by asking director John Avnet about this criticism leveled against the film.
You know, one of the things that a lot of critics pointed to was the fact that the book made the relationship, the romantic relationship between the two central characters, very explicit. You chose not to do that. And what I find interesting is that while critics pointed to that and said that was a failure of the movie in some ways, it still got an award from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation for the best feature film with lesbian content. What was your reaction to the sort of the two dual interpretations?
Well, the dichotomy has a lot to do with point of view. First of all, it's inaccurate to say the book was more demonstrative in terms of the relationship. Actually, if you look at it, it was less demonstrative. There was just one particular line which was not as strong as what was said in the film. In the film, when Mary Louise Parker was on the stand, she says, "She's my best friend and I love her." And I think a lot of people had political intentions in what they wrote, and they were writing about a world that they knew very little about. The customs and behavior in different parts of the country have been different over time. And a lot of times, women have had many different kinds of relationships. And the drawing of what becomes a gay relationship is a definition that, when the film came out, was different than it is today. I think people look at gender fluidity in a much more sophisticated and realistic way. At the time, you were either A or B. I don't find that to be the truth. And so I feel that a lot of what was written about it was really naive and incorrect. What was important to me in doing the movie was that we could explore relationships between women, all forms of relationships, and explore intimacy between women. And this was not something that was commonplace at the time. Actually, it's not even that commonplace now.
Yeah.
And that was my goal. That's what moved me. And I believe that's what moved an audience. And it's also why it traveled between both gay audiences and straight audiences.
This was one of the first big kind of breakthrough roles for Kathy Bates. What did you see in her or like in her that let you choose her to star in this film?
Well, I wouldn't use the word like. I would use another four-letter word, and it would be love. She's just a phenomenal actress who I'd seen a number of times on Broadway and was very, very happy to have the opportunity to bring her to screen on a couple of movies, including Men Don't Leave. And I was just imagining her and Jessica Tandy for the roles that they played in Fried Green Tomatoes. She's just a flawless, truthful actress and also has deep Southern roots, which I think was quite important for this movie.
I wanted to play a little clip here because this was one of my favorite moments, actually, in the film. This is in the scene in which Evelyn is Kathy Bates' character, and she's talking to her husband, and she's told him that she plans to bring Mrs. Threadgood in, to move in with them in their home.
It's never going to happen, so just forget about it.
Don't you ever say never to me. Someone helped put a mirror up in front of my face. And I didn't like what I saw one bit. And you know what I did? I changed. And that someone was Mrs. Threadgood. She needs my love and care now, and I'm going to give it to her.
So this was not, you know, growing up in the Los Angeles area for me, this was not my image of the Southern woman. And I wonder how you felt about these particular moments, these moments in which Fannie Flagg, who ended up writing a large portion of the script for you, was herself flouting Southern stereotype.
First of all, Fanny and Carol Sobieski, who were the credited writers, wrote a bit of it. I wrote most of it. I was not credited. So a lot of those, all those words are my words.
Really?
So, oh, yes. And by the way, it was a bit of a contentious thing. But if you ask Fanny, are you looking, you know, a number of things she said, she's been very, very generous about that after the fact. But what the story was about was the power of storytelling and how it could affect people. And particularly, obviously, it was Kathy Bates' character. And in many ways, it was, to a lot of New Yorkers, very behind the times. And in some ways, many people in the South were a little slower to adopt things. But it is naive, it is simplistic, and it is degrading to describe Southern women as less than anybody else. And that was something that really annoyed me. And the way that Kathy grew and how she grew was endemic to her character. And her character can't be delinked from her upbringing and being part of the South. But there's a power to Southern women. There's always been a power to Southern women. And to say anything else is just ridiculous. So for me, you know, to see her bloom, to see her blossom, to see her love come and turn into action, not just words, within the context of a relationship that was, you know, to some extent prototypical or archetypal, that was exciting. That was fun. And Kathy really went with it. And I loved when she said to Ed, you're trying to kill me. She says, if I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands.
What the hell's this?
That's a low cholesterol meal. Happy Valentine's.
God, are you trying to kill me?
If I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands. Stop in the name of love.
So the anger that she was feeling is part of being liberated. And I think this is a story of her being liberated by these two women who she's learning about.
Since you brought up Carol Sobieski, I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I understand that the first sort of draft she brought to you was a musical.
Yes. Carol was a brilliant writer and a wonderful woman. And I told her what I wanted, and she said, look, John, I really get it. Would you let me do my version first, and then I'll do whatever you want? Literally, I will do whatever you want. Well, she wrote this, you know, musical where the past and the present, they were all singing together and getting together in the nursing home. And it was wonderful. It just wasn't the movie that I was going to make. I asked her if she would now, you know, honor what she said. She did. She took a shot at it. And then very honestly and very openly and very, in a very emotional way, she said, John, either you should write this or Fanny should write this. I'm the wrong person for this. And volunteered not to continue to be paid and actually said she didn't want credit.
Frank Bennett won't be bothering you no more. You understand?
You killed him.
No. You don't believe me. Right now, I don't know what to believe.
That's a scene from the 1991 film Fried Green Tomatoes. It was filmed in Juliet, Georgia. We're spending this hour looking back at two Hollywood classics that were filmed right here in Georgia. The 1991 film Fried Green Tomatoes tells the story of a housewife, played by Kathy Bates, who befriends an elderly woman named Ninny, played by Jessica Tandy. Ninny recalls her amazing story of growing up in Alabama. And the film centers on the murder of Frank Bennett, an abusive husband of Ninny's friend, Ruth. I talked about the film with its director, John Avnet, and played for him this scene of a sheriff investigating the murder.
What we're talking about is murder here. Running afoul of the law, and don't nobody get away with that. Not even a bunch of Alabama smartass. If I find so much as a half his head, I'll arrest you fast and you can slap a tick. Because I'm the law, and you can't beat the law.
You're laughing. Why does that make you laugh?
I love Rainer Schein, and I love his accent. I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed, I love the Southern voice. I just love it. And I spent quite a bit of time listening and trying to study to get a sense of, you know, where people were from and what the roots might be. But mostly, it's the music of it. And, boy, he is musical. And so I love that. I just love that scene. You ain't fooling me, girly girl. I know who you are. Yeah, he was great.
Although I just talked to Jack McBrayer, who introduced the film at the Atlanta Film Festival, and he has a very recognizable Georgia accent, says he can't get any work in the state.
Well, he should wait for me to show up because I love the sound of the voice in Georgia and Alabama. It's a little different in some of the deeper southern areas than the northern part of Georgia, Tate and up there. But it's quite interesting, the whatever the etymology of the voice is.
It's interesting to hear you say that, though, because the thing I hear most often, especially from people working in Hollywood and in the movie business, is that when you use a southern accent, it's most often assumed that person is dumb.
Those people didn't see the Watergate hearings and haven't been cross-examined by a Southern lawyer recently. I would posit that behind some of that local quality is a rare and very incisive intelligence, as well as, you know, a kind of what I would say being a little bit more at one with nature than people who are city folk.
I'm told that when your production designer found the Whistle Stop Cafe, it was not a cafe, it was an antique store, and you got to build that horseshoe-shaped counter specifically
Yes.
because it was better for filming, right?
Yes. Barbara Lang was the production designer, and when she brought me to Juliet, which was like a ghost town covered in kudzu, very few people, this antique shop, which I was told was open 1 hour a week, was situated in a way that it had a view of a railroad track that was only being used to bring coal down to the power plant. And I had hoped I could convince the powers that be that I could put a, you know, period locomotive on there. That was a long, long story and very difficult to do. But with the, you know, approval of the various federal agencies and the railroad agencies, and when we had our railroad man there, Sid, you know, we were able to do it. So it had a great view because back then we didn't have CGI. So putting a train next to the
interesting.
Whistle
think
stop.
About that.
And when you think whistle stop comes from, you know, the whistle.
Right, the train whistle.
Exactly. And by the way, we also found the depot in the woods with trees growing through it. And my Georgia boys from Macon, the Grips, cut down the trees, built a little road, and they rolled the thing, put it up by the
You're
tracks.
Kidding me. That building was original.
That building was original. I mean, obviously, we redid it, restructured it, and so on and so forth, but it was original, and we put it where it was. And then in terms of the design of the cafe, again, Barbara was a very talented designer, wonderful collaborator, just a very talented woman. She showed me that horseshoe design, and I went, do it. Let's do it. Because it gave me the ability, one, to see the tracks. Also, I could see out back where Smokey Lonesome would be with Mary Stuart Masterson when he was having the shakes. And you could also see Cicely Tyson, who's a big part of this movie to me, you know, poking her head in and out of the kitchen there with George, Big George. And it just created a world. And we were also able to, you know, use, you know, a lot of elements. Like we had these amber shades in there that gave, you know, a real color, a warmth to the place, which could be pulled up or pulled down. And one of the key images to me was the sort of that gunshot through the window, that yeah. spidering of the glass. And if you actually look at the movie in terms of telling the story visually, the first time you see it, you see a spider, then you see the window being painted with fried green tomatoes served hot at the Whistle Stop Cafe, and then you see the night when the Klan shows up and they blow out the window, and you could tell the story in many ways visually just through that image. And, you know, again, a lot of this was Barbara's imagination. She actually showed me a shot of the spidered glass for no purpose at all, and I went, oh, I like that. I like that. I can use that.
So we're 25 years on, and people are still going to see this movie. I wonder what you hope the movie's legacy will be.
Well, you know, I at this point or when I made it?
Well, let's hear both.
Well, when I made it, you know, I was, you know, I'm a sort of not closeted feminist. You know, I had done in 1984 The Burning Bed, you know, with Farrah Fawcett. That was about domestic violence, and it was an important movie to me and an important movie, much more importantly, to many women who were battered.
And the Fried Green Tomatoes is also about domestic violence.
Yes, that is a theme that you will see in my pieces, and you will see more coming up, because I just hate it. I just really despise the fact that, you know, women historically started out as chattel, I can't pronounce it properly, but were enslaved, and you know the fact that violence was used against them just is obscene. So at any rate, you know, this was yet another opportunity to tell a story that had an element of that. So what I wanted to get across, as I said before briefly, was I was so interested in why so many women are closer to women than to the men that they're married with or their fathers or their children, you know, and whether they were gay or straight. That seemed to be something that was worth exploring. It was and is a phenomenon that I don't think a lot of people have written about in ways that have really moved me or educated me. So that's what I wanted to explore.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking this hour about Hollywood classics that were filmed in Georgia. My Cousin Vinny premiered 25 years ago to critical and popular acclaim. It was filmed in Monticello, Georgia. It tells the story of an inexperienced New York attorney who takes on the biggest case of his career, a murder trial.
You're a trial attorney, right? I mean, personal injury trials.
Well, actually, this would be my first foray into the trial process.
That's actor Joe Pesci playing the inexperienced attorney Vinny Gambini. This year, we looked back at the film's legacy with its director, Jonathan Lynn. Lynn is originally from the UK, and I asked him how hard it was to understand Southern culture.
Well, I suppose as a foreigner, I didn't see a lot of difference between the various American cultures. As you know, Hollywood history is littered with European directors who have made American films.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Wilder and Michael Curtiz and Fred Zinnemann and Milos Forman, and the list is absolutely endless, as you know. And to me, the difference between the North and the South was not all that significant. What I found when I read the script was it was a film about class, which, of course, the Brits really know about. Vinny and Lisa are both working class. They're both ex-garage mechanics. He's become a lawyer. She's become a hairdresser. And in the South, they're up against an establishment of old money. The judge went to Yale. The prosecutor is Jim Trotter III. I saw a lot of class issues in the script.
That is fascinating to me. I want to play a clip real quick that may demonstrate what you're talking about. This is actually one of the many run-ins that Vinny has with the judge, played by Fred Gwynne. In this scene, Vinny has come in wearing this very outdated, brightly colored, almost fuchsia suit, and the judge takes him to task. Let's take a listen.
Are you mocking me with that outfit?
Mocking you? No, I'm not mocking you, Judge.
Then explain that outfit.
I bought a suit. You seen it. Now it's covered in mud. This town doesn't have a one-hour cleaners, so I had to buy a new suit. Except that the only store you could buy a new suit in has got the flu. You get that? The whole store got the flu. So I had to get this in a secondhand store.
So I saw that as a class of cultures, a New York culture coming up against a Southern culture. You saw that as a class of class.
I saw it as both. I think it's Brooklyn versus Alabama. But I think it's also a class issue. I think as a blue-collar guy, Vinny didn't have any problem with appearing in court in a very nice leather jacket, very expensive leather jacket. The judge said a leather jacket wasn't permissible. It had to be a suit. The judge is very old school. Vinny is a New Yorker, but it's also a class thing.
So the reason why it's being shown as part of the Food on Film series, I think, is a guess because of this scene about grits. And grits are about as Southern as you can get. Let's take a listen to that scene.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Yeah, honey, you can try it.
You first.
Did you have any grit? Did you taste grits before you filmed this scene?
I have tasted grits, yes.
Did you like them? How do you eat your grits?
Well, I don't want to insult your audience. But it's not my favorite food, I have to say. But that's not the point. You don't have to try everything yourself in order to be able to direct a scene about it. Really, the thing about making a movie as a foreigner is that unlike on stage, where you have to create the environment, the set, the ambiance, we went to the South. We actually went to Georgia to make the film, to Atlanta or Monticello, rather than Alabama, because Georgia has a film industry. But essentially, you go to where you're shooting, and it's what you are shooting. You don't have to have pretense. I went to a murder trial near Atlanta, and watched it for 3 or 4 days as part of my prep for the movie. And in fact, the courtroom that we built for the film is pretty much the same as the courtroom that I saw a real murder trial in. And I watched the whole procedure. I watched the way they selected the jury. I watched the behavior of the judges and the judge and the lawyers. And it's not that hard, whether you're a foreigner or an American, to shoot something that's there in reality. And then you have the advantage of American actors, you know, who know how to play those parts, who do understand the culture. So for me, it's all just a question of storytelling.
Let's take a listen to a scene from the film. We see several breakdowns throughout the movie of East Coast versus Southern dialect. Probably the most memorable exchange on that is in the courtroom between attorney Vinnie Gambini and Judge Haller.
Is it possible to two youths...
To what? What was that word?
What word?
To what?
What?
Did you say youths?
Yeah, two youths.
What is a ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
So, over the past 25 years, how has your, has your view of this film changed? I mean, how has it weathered for you?
My view of this film has improved, I think. At the time we finished it, it was a tremendous battle to get it out there. It was a not very expensive film, well below average budget.
Are you saying it was a battle to get enough press and attention to the film? Is that what you mean?
Oh, yes, it was. It was very hard to get the film to open. We didn't have recognized stars. We were opening round about the same, I think it was either the same week or the week before or after, Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts, which was causing a sensation. And it was very hard to get to encapsulate what made the film work so well.
That's filmmaker Jonathan Lynn. He directed the 1992 film My Cousin Vinny. Just ahead, more of my conversation with him. First, though, take a couple minutes out of your day, if you would, to support this show and GPB. The amount that you give really does not matter, really. But every donation does matter. So here is how you support the show.
No process.
That's actor Joe Pesci playing the inexperienced attorney Vinnie Gambini. This year, we looked back at the film's legacy with its director, Jonathan Lynn. Lynn is originally from the UK, and I asked him how hard it was to understand Southern culture.
Well, I suppose as a foreigner, I didn't see a lot of difference between the various American cultures. As you know, Hollywood history is littered with European directors who have made American films.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Wilder and Michael Curtiz and Fred Zinnemann and Milos Forman, and the list is absolutely endless, as you know. And to me, the difference between the North and the South was not all that significant. What I found when I read the script was it was a film about class, which, of course, the Brits really know about. Vinny and Lisa are both working class. They're both ex-garage mechanics. He's become a lawyer. She's become a hairdresser. And in the South, they're up against an establishment of old money. The judge went to Yale. The prosecutor is Jim Trotter III. I saw a lot of class issues in the script.
That is fascinating to me. I want to play a clip real quick that may demonstrate what you're talking about. This is actually one of the many run-ins that Vinny has with the judge, played by Fred Gwynn. In this scene, Vinny has come in wearing this very outdated brightly colored, almost fuchsia suit. And the judge takes him to task. Let's take a listen.
Are you mocking me with that outfit?
Mocking you? No, I'm not mocking you, Judge.
Then explain that outfit.
I bought a suit. You've seen it. Now it's covered in mud. This town doesn't have a one-hour cleaner, so I had to buy a new suit. Except that the only store you could buy a new suit in has got the flu. You get that? The whole store got the flu. So I had to get this in a secondhand store.
So I saw that as a clash of cultures, a New York culture coming up against a Southern culture. You saw that as a clash of class.
I saw it as both. I think it's Brooklyn versus Alabama. But I think it's also a class issue. I think as a blue collar guy, Vinny didn't have any problem with appearing in court in a very nice leather jacket, very expensive leather jacket. The judge said a leather jacket wasn't permissible. It had to be a suit. The judge is very old school. Vinny is a New Yorker, but it's also a class thing.
So the reason why it's being shown as part of the Food on Film series, I think, is a guess because of this scene about grits. And grits are about as Southern as you can get. Let's take a listen to that scene.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Yeah, honey, you can try it.
You first.
Did you have any grit? Did you taste grits before you filmed this scene?
I have tasted grits, yes.
Did you like them? How do you eat your grits?
Well, I don't want to insult your audience, but it's not my favorite food, I have to say. But that's not the point. You don't have to try everything yourself in order to be able to direct a scene about it. Really, the thing about making a movie as a foreigner is that, unlike on stage, where you have to create the environment, the set, the ambiance, we went to the South. We actually went to Georgia to make the film, to Atlanta or Monticello, rather than Alabama, because Georgia has a film industry. But essentially, you go to where you're shooting, and it's what you are shooting. You don't have to have pretense. I went to a murder trial near Atlanta, and watched it for 3 or 4 days as part of my prep for the movie. And in fact, the courtroom that we built for the film is pretty much the same as the courtroom that I saw a real murder trial in. And I watched the whole procedure. I watched the way they selected the jury. I watched the behavior of the judges and the judge and the lawyers. And it's not that hard, whether you're a foreigner or an American, to shoot something that's there in reality. And then you have the advantage of American actors, you know, who know how to play those parts, who do understand the culture. So for me, it's all just a question of storytelling.
Let's take a listen to a scene from the film. We see several breakdowns throughout the movie of East Coast versus Southern dialect. Probably the most memorable exchange on that is in the courtroom between attorney Vinnie Gambini and Judge Holler.
Is it possible the two utes...
To what? What was that word?
What word?
To what?
What?
Did you say utes?
Yeah, two utes.
What is a ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
So, over the past 25 years, how has your, has your view of this film changed? I mean, how has it weathered for you?
My view of this film has improved, I think. At the time we finished it, it was a tremendous battle to get it out there. It was a not very expensive film, well below average budget.
Are you saying it was a battle to get enough press and attention to the film? Is that what you mean?
Oh, yes, it was. It was very hard to get the film to open. We didn't have recognized stars. We were opening round about the same, I think it was either the same week or the week before or after Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts, which was causing a sensation. And it was very hard to get to encapsulate what made the film work so well.
That's filmmaker Jonathan Lynn. He directed the 1992 film My Cousin Vinny. All this hour, we revisit Hollywood classics that were produced right here in Georgia. I want to return to my conversation with Jonathan Lynn. He directed the 1992 movie My Cousin Vinny. It was shown this year at the Atlanta Film Festival as part of the annual Food on Film series. Director Jonathan Lynn says it was initially pretty difficult to get a widespread release for the film.
You know, it had not been a very important film in their schedule. And so there was they stopped the release date. They rethought. The release date was postponed by 3 or 4 months. And Joe Roth, who was chairman of the studio, did something really, I thought, daring and clever. He said, the only way we can sell this film is by showing it to people and getting good word of mouth. So they did, I think it was 900 screenings all over America, free screenings. And people came to them, they got people in one way or another, and people came out of the screenings and talked about the movie, so that by the time we opened, there was great word of mouth.
Did that strategy worry you? Were you afraid the film wasn't going to make money?
You're always afraid that every film isn't going to make money. it was my third film, I didn't know such a lot about film marketing. I did know that they were right when they said the way people will be interested in this film is if their friends tell them to go see it. It was very hard to come up with a trailer that captured the mood and the sense of the film and how funny it is and how well it develops. But anyway, you asked me if my view of the film had changed over the years. I think I like it more as time goes by. I don't see it very often, but on the rare occasions that I've watched it, I've been pleased with the work we did. And I can't always say that about, you know, usually you look at your own work and you think, oh, I wish I'd changed this, or I wish I hadn't done that, or you know, you have all kinds of thoughts. I wish I'd cut that scene more strictly. You know, there's all kinds of things that you see that you can improve. And when I look at Vinny, I'm pleased with it.
Did you know that some teachers are using My Cousin Vinny as a teaching aid for young lawyers?
I did. I'm a recovering lawyer myself. I have a degree in law, and I was very keen that it should be legally absolutely accurate. But I was surprised about 15 years ago when I got invited to speak on a panel at a convention of judges, and it was something to do with the way Hollywood presents trials and the law. And I discovered that they all really love My Cousin Vinny. Then I discovered that Justice Scalia, this was his favorite film.
Antonin Scalia, the former Supreme Court justice.
Yes, yes. So, you know, at least he got one thing right. And I do have a friend who's a federal judge in South Carolina who is a fan of this film to such an extent that he went to the Sack of Suds, which is the convenience store where the two boys were accused of stealing at the beginning of the movie and of murdering the clerk. And he went to the Sack of Suds and bought the sign. And it now hangs in his chambers.
A federal judge has the Sack of Suds sign in his chambers?
Yes. And he teaches evidence at various law schools. And he always uses My Cousin Vinny. And then this winter, I couldn't go, unfortunately, but I was invited to speak at a big convention in South Carolina by the retiring Chief Justice there, who it turns out is also an enthusiast about the movie. And it seems that they all regard it as the most accurate film about a trial that's ever been made. It's the only film they've ever seen where there are no legal mistakes.
Wow.
I think that's the reason they like it so much, but of course I can't be sure. But I do know they use it as a teaching aid in law schools everywhere.
So you have an unusual number of films in your repertoire that have become cult classics. not just this one, but that people like to watch again and again and again. But there's also Clue. There's The Whole Nine Yards. Are you aware of something you're doing differently that makes something people still watch a movie and actually study a movie a quarter of a century later? Is that something that is conscious?
I'm constantly surprised at that several of my films seem to have acquired this sort of fanatical following. I get more emails and fan mail about Clue than I do even about My Cousin Vinny. And people seem to be absolutely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
It was my first film. That is a film I look at and see all kinds of things I should have done differently. But it's really nice that people still love it. The Whole Nine Yards, I think, worked well. I'm pleased with The Whole Nine Yards. There's another film of mine that may be my favorite, which was called Nuns on the Run, which is not shown here very much. It was a British movie with Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle, and made by Handmade Films, which was George Harrison's company. I just do what I think is funny and interesting. We all know that comedy is about timing, but the difference in time in the timing of a funny take and an unfunny take of exactly the same line or exactly the same moment is huge. What you are is the audience, and you sit by the camera or stand by the camera and you watch a take and you think, did that work? And if it didn't work, you have to ask yourself, why not? Was it too slow? Was it too fast? Was the timing of that wrong? Was the thought not clear? You ask yourself every possible question and then you do it again. And when you think that works, you move on. And beyond that, it's just, I don't think I'm able to describe the process.
That's filmmaker Jonathan Lynn. He directed the 1992 movie My Cousin Vinny. It was shot in Monticello, Georgia.